Today, the former special counsel who investigated President Biden's mishandling of classified documents, a man named Robert Hur, was grilled by House members on Capitol Hill. The former special counsel has already declined to charge President Biden with anything, concluding officially that nothing President Biden did was worthy of prosecution. But that did not stop Republicans in Congress from making a four-hour circus out of Mr. Hur's testimony today. And that's because today's hearing wasn't actually about matters of law. It was about scoring political points. The reality here is that the only reason Joe Biden accidentally taking some classified documents with him when he left office, the only reason that matters at all is because Donald Trump willfully, purposefully took classified documents with him when he left office and then tried to obstruct justice to cover it all up. These two cases are not the same. But don't just take my word for that. Here is former special counsel Hur reading from his very own report on the matter.
Unlike the evidence involving Mr. Biden, the allegations set forth in the indictment of Mr. Trump, if proven, would present serious aggravating facts.
Keep going.
Congresswoman, I'm happy to have you read the words in my report.
Well, it's your report, so I think it actually is more fitting that you read those.
Most notably, after being given multiple chances to return classified documents and avoid prosecution, Mr. Trump allegedly did the opposite.
Keep going.
According to the indictment, he not only refused to return the documents for many months, but he also obstructed justice by enlisting others to destroy evidence and then to lie about it.
We'll get into Hur's apparent reluctance there to read aloud the negative parts about Donald Trump, even if they were parts he wrote. But Congresswoman Madeline Dean, in this exchange, forced Mr. Hur to highlight the most important conclusion in this whole thing. In one case, Biden's, you have what seems to be a legitimate mistake, followed by full cooperation with law enforcement. And in the other, Trump's, you have what appears to be criminal intent and obstruction of justice. And as if to underscore the chasm that separates these cases, yesterday we got even more evidence of just how intentionally criminal Donald Trump's actions appear to be. On Monday, one of the witnesses in this classified documents investigation, one of the witnesses came forward. And up until yesterday, we knew this witness only as Trump Employee 5. CNN is now reporting that his name is Brian Butler. He was a longtime employee at Mar-a-Lago, and he witnessed some incredibly damning things, like the day that Trump flew from Florida to Bedminster in New Jersey. Trump's body man and his co-defendant, Walt Nauta, asked Mr. Butler to get Mr. Nauta a big SUV, an Escalade. Butler then saw Nauta and Trump's other co-defendant, Carlos de Oliveira, load the vehicle up with 10 to 15 banker's boxes and then drive them to Trump's plane and then load those banker's boxes onto the plane. Mr. Butler said that all took place on June 3rd, 2022. Now, later that same day, one of Trump's lawyers provided investigators with what he said was the entirety of classified documents that remained in Mr. Trump's possession, as well as a sworn certification that falsely claimed on Trump's behalf that he and Team Trump had conducted a diligent search of boxes and all responsive documents had been turned over. So what Brian Butler is now asserting here is pretty explosive. Not only did Trump apparently hide away at least 105 classified documents that the FBI eventually found, it sure sounds like Trump managed to steal another 10 to 15 boxes of records, and we don't know if the FBI ever got those records back. Who knows where those boxes are now? That sure sounds like obstruction of justice. What is equally concerning here is why Brian Butler decided to go public right now. Here he was explaining his decision.
Well, I mean, it's been almost a year since FBI agents showed up at my house when my wife was at home. And, you know, over the course of the last year, emotionally, it's been a roller coaster. You know, a couple weeks ago, Judge Cannon says she's going to release the names of the witnesses. You know, you go from highs and lows in this. And instead of just waiting for it to just come out, I think it's better that I get to at least say what happened than it coming out in the news, people calling me like crazy. I'd rather just get it out there. And, you know, the hope is at least I can move on with my life. and get over this.
Brian Butler coming forward here is brave. President Trump has a track record of trying to influence or intimidate witnesses who speak out against him. And his followers have a track record of harassing and threatening anyone they perceive to be one of Donald Trump's enemies. So coming out in this big public way is in itself a big deal. As the months go on, the list of Trump's transgressions, if not the list of his actual crimes, those lists continue to grow. And yet, for now, the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case is on hold. And instead of talking about a trial in Congress, the focus instead is on President Biden and not just how he handled classified documents, which as a legal matter is already settled. Instead, the focus is on Biden's age and whether he is fit to be president. The former special counsel himself played a huge role in that. His report made broad and seemingly unusual characterizations about Biden's age. And now one of the Congress people who questioned her today was Congressman Adam Schiff. Remember that before becoming a congressman, Schiff spent years as the assistant U.S. attorney for the Central District of California, meaning he is a stranger to how a prosecution like he is no stranger to how a prosecution like this should be run. He knows the rules, and he does not think the former special counsel has followed them.
Politics played no part whatsoever in my investigative steps.
You understood, nevertheless, Mr. Hur, you cannot tell me you're so naive as to think your words would not have created a political firestorm. You understood that, didn't you? You understood how they would be manipulated by my colleagues here on the GOP side of the aisle and by President Trump. You understood that, did you not?
Congressman, what I understood is the regulations that govern my conduct as special counsel.
And those regulations
me to write a confidential report for the Attorney General.
Which you knew would not be confidential.
My decision, and that is what I did, Congressman.
Mr.
I followed the rules.
What is in the rules is you don't gratuitously do things to prejudice the subject of an investigation when you're declining to prosecute. You don't gratuitously add language that you know will be useful in a political campaign. You were not born yesterday. You made a choice. That was a political choice. It was the wrong choice. Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
Joining me now is Congressman Adam Schiff of California. He's a member of the House Judiciary Committee and former lead House impeachment manager during the first Senate impeachment trial of then-President Trump. Congressman Schiff, it's great to see you. Made an impact today, shall we say, in your questioning of the former special counsel. And I just wonder what your assessment was after you asked him, I think quite credibly, whether he actually believed that this was not a political document or that he did not make any political considerations when assessing President Biden's memory. Did you believe him?
No, I didn't believe him at all. He tried to claim this was a confidential memo, but it was also forced to acknowledge he knew it would be made public. The attorney general had made it clear it would be public. And the idea that he was required to give this, personalized, prejudicial, biased, essentially broadside against the president, that was necessary to his report, is absurd. He could have commented all he wanted on, the president's specific recollection as to this document or that document. That would have been appropriate. But he understands, having done dozens and dozens of depositions, witnesses are instructed if they don't remember something clearly, they should say they don't recall. There's nothing at all unusual about that. And to take this political potshot at the president during the midst of a campaign when he knows how it would be used was, grave abuse of prosecutorial authority. And he knows it.
I also felt like he sort of wanted to issue a backhanded, not quite indictment of the president. He refused. He got into a big back and forth with Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal over whether or not the president was exonerated by his report. And he kept saying, I did not exonerate him. Why, if he wasn't going to charge him, do you think he refused to say, I do not exonerate him?
Well, I think you saw in the clip you played his reluctance to even read portions of his report that were critical of Donald Trump. My sense was what he decided to do was, lacking the evidence to make a recommendation to charge the president, he would do the next best thing, which is give them a political bludgeon, attack the president's memory, paint an unflattering portrait of him. that in many ways was more damaging than any observation he might have made about the facts or the chargeability of those facts. And so I think he has a tough time criticizing Trump. He may have future political ambitions. He doesn't want to alienate someone who might be president. He doesn't want to alienate the Republican Party. And so I think this is his effort, failing to find facts to charge or recommend charges to gratify the Trump crowd.
What do you make of the fundamental issue on display here, or the fundamental conclusion that I think is worth repeating over and over again? The vast, vast gulf that separates what President Biden did versus what former President Trump did on the matter of classified document retention. Do you think Democrats made a forceful enough distinction, as it were, given all that Republicans had stored up, the political bludgeon, as you call it, to try and muddy the waters, to try and impugn President Biden's reputation, his age, and his fitness for office?
I think, yes. Madeline, I think, did a great job. Ted Lieu also went through, itemized a number of the charges against Donald Trump, the actions of Trump in concealing materials and trying to get people to lie about it, and talking about scrubbing the server that had the surveillance footage on it. In all these respects, just night and day with President Biden's not deliberate effort his to retain documents, with his full cooperation, with his lengthy interviews. It was a sharp contrast. I think Democrats made that contrast. But I also think that it became clear watching her respond to questions that this is not some neutral, objective, nonpartisan prosecutor. This is someone who was a Republican appointee who really found it difficult, even though, as you say, it was his own words, to read from his own report in ways that would be critical of Donald Trump. And so I think the public got a sense of who he is, where he's coming from, that this is not a neutral arbiter.
Independent of what Republicans and former Special Counsel Herr have to say about it, I do wonder how much of an impact the latest developments out of the classified documents case, how much of an impact do you think that's going to have with the American public as we head into an election season where we may not get any of the federal criminal trials? They may not happen before the election. We have a witness coming forth and saying that not only did Donald Trump retain over 100 classified documents at his residence, he may have actually stolen 10 to 15 bankers' boxes more and, sent them to points north or wherever. Do you think that that has the impact that it necessarily should? Or do you think that there has been some false equivalence made between Biden taking things, regardless of the fact that it wasn't criminal, and what Trump did? I mean, do you think that the sort of transgressions of that case have lost their impact in the court of public opinion?
I don't think they've lost their impact, but as the indictments were some time ago, I think it is valuable to remind people of these egregious facts. And I think Mr. Butler coming forward, particularly, as you say, given that the trial doesn't look like it's going to go forward before the election, to say, hey, the president was involved in hiding these classified materials. I was asked in a very strange, suspicious way to load or help load these boxes of documents. On the same day, it turns out, the president's lawyers are meeting with the Justice Department to go over these classified materials. Lord knows what happened to all of these documents or some of these documents. I thought Mr. Butler's statements also about having this billionaire foreign person talking about Russian and other submarine capabilities or U.S. capabilities, the astonishment that the president would talk to some, wealthy, and I don't know whether this is a donor or just wealthy patron at Mar-a-Lago, shows you what a security, national security risk that whole Mar-a-Lago enterprise was. Donald Trump's willingness to discuss, to show photographs of things to different parties that were potentially classified materials. It's terrifying to think of him getting classified briefings now. And I really hope the agencies dumb it down so they don't share anything with the president that they don't want shared with the world.
Yeah, only material that's published, in the New York Times or Washington Post or the LA Times, that he probably won't read either. Congressman Adam Schiff, thank you so much for making the time tonight. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We have a lot to get to this evening, including what a doctored photo of the royal family means for American politics. Plus, potential presidential spoiler, RFK Jr. announces that his short list for running mate includes, surprise, a very prominent anti-vaxxer. What that could mean for November coming up.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at msnbc.com/win.
And then there was one time he said, you know, we're all dirty. We all move boxes. And I said, well, look, I didn't even know what I was moving until I was at the plane. And that's when I remember moving boxes.
We're all dirty. We all move boxes. Maybe you, but not me. Unless there are empty Amazon boxes. The man speaking there is Brian Butler, a formerly longtime Mar-a-Lago employee who quit 3 months after the FBI searched the property. Butler testified to special counsel Jack Smith's team and is reportedly referenced in the criminal indictment as Trump employee number 5. Now, while NBC News has not independently confirmed Mr. Butler's role here, the fact that he has come forward now is telling. Any day now, the judge in this case, Eileen Cannon, may release the identities of unnamed potential witnesses, like witness number 5, which puts at least a dozen others like Mr. Butler at risk. Judge Cannon has yet to rule on whether she will release the names of those witnesses for the prosecution. She held a hearing 11 days ago on the matter. As far as that trial date, that is still very much TBD. Joining me now to discuss all of this is MSNBC legal analyst Lisa Rubin. Lisa, it's always so wonderful to have you on set here to explain my continued confusion about what exactly is happening down in Florida. And other legal scholars.
Yeah.
What's Cannon going to do here? I mean, this seems like a very bad call just on its face. Witnesses should be protected, especially those who, you know, the president has a history of maligning, if not outright harassing.
It was really interesting. I was reading the transcript of the argument that you were just referring to earlier tonight. And Cannon clearly still has a leaning toward revealing their names. And she actually asked David Harbach of the special counsel's office verbatim, has there been any indication that any of these witnesses have been threatened? And his response was sort of incredulous, but then he said to her, well, that's not the standard, Your Honor. We don't have to show
right.
that a witness has been threatened in order to make a credible case to you that the revelation of their names would compromise this investigation as well as their public safety.
Do you feel like if she says no, Jack Smith takes this to the 11th Circuit?
I do. I think Jack Smith does take this to the 11th Circuit because it's not just about Brian Butler as Trump employee number 5,
yeah.
who has now unveiled himself willingly. There are 20 to 25 other witnesses, according to Harbaugh's estimation, that could be impacted. And it's not just their identities, Alex. I want to be clear with you and our viewers. It's about the substance of their expected testimony as well. There could also be communications between members of the prosecution team, between and among them about some of these witnesses. And some of them are incidental. Let's say they're talking about Lisa Rubin, a witness, and lower down in the chain, they're talking about Alex Wagner. You could end up having Alex Wagner's name out in the public domain, even though it's entirely incidental to the purpose for which that exhibit was used in these underlying motions. That is the subject of this unsealing order.
I do wonder when we talk about the sort of the most explosive elements of this interview with Mr. Butler, I was shocked at his account of helping to load 10 to 15 bankers' boxes. Banker's boxes that he said looked very much like the boxes storing classified documents that we've seen photos of in the indictment document, that those 10 to 15 boxes were loaded onto a plane and took off. To me, if I'm the special counsel, first of all, they knew this months ago.
Yep.
Why not continue looking for them. What does that reflect on the part of Jack Smith?
Well, first of all, we don't know that they haven't recovered them. It could be that they have determined that all of those boxes were returned to Mar-a-Lago or somewhere else, that they essentially followed Trump around wherever he went. I had a conversation with someone on your team tonight about our shared recollection that when Trump showed up in New York last year for a deposition in the New York Attorney General's civil fraud case, he was seen outside Trump Tower with personal aides carting some of those very same sorts of banker's boxes. Look, there is a reference in the indictment to the fact that Carlos De Oliveira, Walt Nauta, and others shepherded boxes onto a plane as Trump was leaving from Florida to head north. It never disclosed, however, that Brian Butler, as Trump employee number 5, was among them. And we don't know for sure what happened to those boxes or what their contents were.
Do you feel confident, though, that the, I mean, I guess in the back of my mind, this is all pure speculation. I should warn everyone at home that, you know, it seems that Jack Smith, probably more than anybody else at the Department of Justice, has understood the abbreviated calendar within which he is working.
Yes.
Right. Like, he built a federal indictment on January 6th that was made for speed. Let's get it done.
Yes.
That is very much up in the air. The Mar-a-Lago classified documents case seems very narrow, very clear. He didn't bother with the dissemination charge,
correct,
for example, saying that Trump was trying to sell these state secrets or spread them, if you will. That seems intentional, right? I'm going to go for the stuff I know I can convict on.
And by the way, he can still use evidence of some of this as proof of intent at trial, even if they don't lead to separate charges. So Jack Smith, to your point, I think has adopted a really surgical approach. He has probably also determined, based on his team's experience with Judge Cannon so far, that further superseding this indictment is to no one's benefit.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean if and when this case were ever to be tried, that we wouldn't see some of the things that Brian Butler talks about in that interview come back and make a reappearance at trial, including through his testimony.
Right. I do think that there's been sort of a fatalist attitude about this because it's unlikely to happen before November, that people think it doesn't matter. But it absolutely, there's a 50% chance that Joe Biden is the president of the United States come November, come the end of November, which means this trial could actually happen. I do wonder what you think the timeline might be for this, given Cannon's seeming indecision to actually set a date.
Well, look, I think a lot depends on what the Supreme Court does on presidential immunity. Trump has made multiple motions to dismiss in this case, two of which will be dealt with later this week. But presidential immunity is not one of them. And depending on what the Supreme Court does, this case could go away or it could come back to Judge Cannon to determine, even if he is immune for acts that are alleged to be official, does the stuff in this indictment count as official acts worthy of immunity? I would tell you, no, they are post-presidential acts that don't qualify. Donald Trump, on the other hand, is saying because they emanate from his lawful possession during his presidency, he is still entitled to cloak himself in the very comfy bathrobe of immunity.
So does that mean he gets to, like, go into the White House at any time, steal a bunch of stuff and say, I mean, I'm not going to ask you to actually answer that, but that seems to be what is suggested by an argument to Trump's merit. Lisa Rubin, it's great to see you, my friend. Thank you for bearing with my questions tonight. I appreciate you, as always. Still to come this evening, why a badly, badly Photoshopped portrait of British royals has implications for American politics. We'll explain coming up. Plus, Trump and Biden cross a crucial presidential campaign milestone tonight. That is about the only thing their campaigns have in common, though. We'll have more on their respective strategies coming up next.
It's Monday, everyone. Happy to have you here on this Monday night. Lots of news to get to tonight.
Make more of your Mondays on MSNBC with Jen Psaki and Rachel Maddow back to back.
If you were talking to a voter, what would you say to them about why this case matters to them?
Was this the kind of proceeding you would expect in a typical New York DA's case, or does this really feel different?
Inside with Jen Psaki at 8 p.m. Eastern, followed by The Rachel Maddow Show at 9, Mondays on MSNBC. Monday night.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
a few hours, when all the votes are tallied in the Washington state primary, Donald Trump is set to become the presumptive Republican presidential nominee. And thanks to a primary win in Georgia, Joe Biden is now the presumptive Democratic nominee. So here we go, general election. But President Biden was not waiting to secure a certain number of delegates in order to shift into general election mode. He released this ad over the weekend going after Donald Trump and taking on the age question head on.
Look, I'm not a young guy. That's no secret. But here's the deal. I understand how to get things done for the American people. I led the country through the COVID crisis. Today, we have the strongest economy in the world. I passed a law that lowers prescription drug prices, caps insulin at $35 a month for seniors. For 4 years, Donald Trump tried to pass an infrastructure law, and he failed. I got it done.
So President Biden is running on the stuff he's done. And Donald Trump? Well, he's firing dozens of people at the Republican National Committee, including its political director, as his campaign takes operational control of that organization. And Trump is calling into national television programs and floating ideas like this.
Have you changed your outlook on how to handle entitlement, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, Mr. President?
There is a lot you can do in terms of entitlements, in terms of cutting.
Trump followed that up by announcing that his first act as president will be to close the border, drill, baby, drill, and free the January 6 hostages. Okay, now, joining me now is Tim Miller, writer-at-large at The Bulwark, and Claire McCaskill, former U.S. Senator for the great state of Missouri. Thank you both for being with me here tonight to understand what is happening. Claire, let me first just ask you, you could talk about the infrastructure bill. You could talk about climate change. You could talk about lowering the cost of very common medications. You could talk about protecting the social safety net. Or you could talk about freeing the January 6 hostages and firing the political director of the RNC. Which strategy would you take, Claire?
I kind of like our side of the fence here. I think Biden's got a stronger hand. And by the way, let's don't leave out the fact that what Donald Trump mostly does is talk about how America sucks. He is constantly trying to convince everyone that we're terrible, that we're in decline, that America is awful. And I don't think that's what most Americans believe or frankly want to hear. I think they want somebody who believes in the goodness of our country, somebody who sees that we are, in fact, in a stronger economic position than any of our country, other developed nations across the globe, that we are doing better than we were under Donald Trump. And I actually think that even though there are still lots of days left before the election, I'd much rather be Joe Biden at this point than Donald Trump. I think he does have the stronger hand.
Tim, we are told repeatedly, largely by Trump's surrogates, that the Trump campaign is a well-oiled machine, better run and managed than it was in 2016. It was a low bar in 2016, admittedly, but they did secure a bunch of endorsements. They do seem to have more of an official campaign apparatus. Having said that, the nationalization of this campaign and the fact that almost all of its appeal rests on the shoulders of Donald Trump, when he's out there saying things like, I'm going to cut Social Security and Medicare, and talking glowingly about January 6 hostages, I just do wonder whether how much the campaign stuff and the adeptness of his campaign actually matters if the principal is saying that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that it's fair to say that they've got some professionals around them right now, that it must be a little bit better than 2016, where he had several campaign managers, and I think most of them were indicted at one point or the other, including Paul Manafort, who was kind of a Russian spy, or at least back channeling to Russia during the 2016 campaign. So pretty low bar for improvement on getting people around him. I think that they've stepped over that. But they have a lot of other things, you know, going against them that they didn't have in 2016. Donald Trump hadn't been indicted 91 times. He didn't have a track record you can compare against. I thought that the infrastructure comparison was the best part of that initial Biden ad, because it addressed both accomplishments, but also it addresses the age contrast in a way, right? That it's like, oh, you're worried that I'm too old. Well, this other guy, this other old guy, by the way, said he was going to do infrastructure every week. And look who did it. I did. So, you know, I think that having a marginally better campaign team, I don't know if that offsets all of the other challenges that Donald Trump faces this time.
Yeah, I agree with you, Tim. And Claire, I wonder what you thought in that ad. It shows when Biden talks about his ability to get infrastructure passed, you see a fumbling image of Donald Trump, which is actually tonally different than what we've seen so far, right? We've seen him as a pernicious, nefarious evildoer, but bumbling, fumbling, and ineffective is actually kind of a new bucket. And I wonder how useful you think that will be as Biden tries to kind of claim a counter-narrative about the Trump years.
Listen, all you have to do is play tape of Donald Trump at some of these rallies when he goes on to these sentences that aren't sentences, and he talks gibberish, and he doesn't know who he's running against, and he's not identifying leaders with the right countries. And then in the middle of it all, he loses his train of thought and kind of goes sideways. He clearly has some cognitive issues. And I think the best thing that's happened in the Biden campaign is they figured out they got to go after Donald Trump. They can't just sit in the Oval Office and be presidential and talk about Bidenomics and talk about what he's gotten done. They have to go after Donald Trump. They're doing that now. And by the way, Donald Trump is helping them by going on a show where he is trying to appeal to rich donors and saying he's willing to cut Social Security and Medicare. These are mistakes that campaign operatives can't fix.
Yeah, to that end, Tim, your bulwark buddy, Sarah Longworth is the head of the Republican Accountability Project. And the reporting is that they are going to spend $50 million in a campaign effectively against Trump. They do not consider themselves a pro-Biden shop, as I'm sure you're well aware, but it's going to feature homemade videos of Americans who voted for Trump, I believe, in the past, whether 2016 or 2020, but have chosen not to in 2024. How effective do you think that will be in moving this sort of critical slice of independent swing voters to the left side of the aisle? How effective will that be?
Yeah, I think Sarah, just to defend her honor, is pro-Biden. But I think that the strategy here is talking to people that might not want to get there around Biden. And I don't get that. It doesn't make sense to me. But I think this is important. When you look at a strategy, there have to be a lot of groups. There are going to be a lot of Democratic groups out there with PACs that are trying to activate young voters or Black voters or other parts of the Democratic coalition. This is a narrowly targeted effort to reach people that are pretty much Republican voters that have voted for Donald Trump, not even like, never Trumpers, right? They're Trump voters. And moving some of them from going from a Trump voter to a nothing, that's a step in the right direction, right? That's a plus one for Joe Biden. Moving them to Joe Biden, that's a full flip. Right? That's what you're trying to do, right? And so in order to do that, these testimonials are them hearing from them. You know, as much as we all like each other, hearing from Claire or hearing from me, even, someone that voted for Hillary, is not going to be as compelling as hearing from somebody like them that looks like them, that sounds like them, that voted for Donald Trump, and now explaining for whatever reason, whether it be January 6th, whether it be his behavior since then, whether it be a change of heart on that way he handled the economy or COVID, that they just can't get around there this time. And we've seen in testing that is, a way to move some of this critical, it's a small number, 1 or 2%, but that could be a meaningful 1 or 2% in a close election.
Yeah, I'm not going to impugn your reputation or Claire's. I don't think anybody who voted for Trump in 2020 is going to listen to me, but I hear what you're saying, Tim. Claire, we have news tonight that Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the third party candidate, maybe choosing Jesse Ventura, former Minnesota governor, or the Jets quarterback Aaron Rodgers, a known anti-vaxxer, to be his running mate. Does this matter at this stage in the game, Claire? Does the continued sort of thorniness of the Kennedy candidacy have the potential to spoil this race?
Well, first, don't get me started on Aaron Rodgers. I mean, are they going to go off and do LSD together in a dark room? And the poor Jets, right? Oh, my God. But here's the thing. We're going to have to spend, people are going to have to spend a lot of money explaining to people in this election that a vote for anyone other than Joe Biden is a vote for Donald Trump. And it's going to be expensive. People don't realize they see the name. I'm looking at all these polls, and yes, he pulls votes from Trump, but he pulls a few points more from Biden. And a lot of that is the name. I think the Kennedy family will get involved. I believe they would, because I know they think this is a horrible idea. But I got to tell you the truth. I don't think Jesse Ventura or Aaron Rodgers is going to help somebody who's got the wacky ideas that Robert F. Kennedy has.
Yeah. To that end, Claire, Maria Shriver was a guest of the president's or the first lady's at the State of the Union. She, of course, is one of the, can we call her a matriarch? One of the most prominent Kennedy family members. So Kennedy v. Kennedy v. Biden. Tim Miller, Claire McCaskill, thank you for joining me this evening. Really appreciate you. Still ahead, the photo that simultaneously broke the internet and public trust. What the British royal photo scandal says about institutional integrity and what Donald Trump had to do with all of it. That is next.
The Palace released a fake photo of Kate Middleton today.
Several news sources have recalled this photo of Kate Middleton and her children because they say that it's been manipulated.
If you look at Princess Charlotte's sweater, you can see that the sweater is not fully there.
Right here where the skirt juts out and it doesn't make any sense. I really believe that this photo was taken back in November of 2023. But of course, they're not going to release a picture that's supposed to be brand new with them all in the same outfits from a publicized event. So they just kind of tinkered it a little bit.
It was literally completely like fakely generated.
By now, you have probably seen the photo that launched 1,000 conspiracy theories. On Sunday, the British royal family released this photo of the Princess of Wales, Kate Middleton, and her family for British Mother's Day. Immediately, people clocked several obvious signs that the photo had been digitally edited. Major news agencies like the Associated Press and Reuters removed the image from their official databases because the image appeared to have been manipulated by the royal family. For context here, Kate Middleton has been absent from public life for about 2 months now. In January, the palace announced she was undergoing abdominal surgery, but it didn't give any details on her diagnosis. So the British public was already awash in conspiracy theories here. And then, in an attempt to kill all the speculation, the royals admitted that the photo they had released had been edited. The official account for Princess Kate tweeted, "Like many amateur photographers, I do occasionally experiment with editing. I wanted to express my apologies for any confusion the family photograph we shared yesterday caused." But that only led to more questions. Questions like, why was the Princess of Wales doing her own crappy photo edits? And how did no one else in the palace catch this? And also, why? I don't know, maybe there's a totally legitimate explanation for all of this. But the global panic that this one photo has caused is something of real concern. The rise of disinformation and misinformation, paired with advances in artificial intelligence, have given rise to a new era of uncertainty, one that threatens to upend our own political system here in the United States. I mean, we've already seen real evidence of how deepfakes are interfering with the election. There was the fake robocall from Joe Biden, or fake Joe Biden, telling Democratic voters to stay home in the state of New Hampshire. And there were the widely circulated fake images of Donald Trump surrounded by black supporters that was generated using AI. But the impact of any single deepfake is ultimately less concerning than the general climate of suspicion generated simply by living in the era of deepfakes. As one Stanford AI researcher told The Atlantic's Charlie Wurzel, you don't need to create the fake video for this tech to have a serious impact. You just point to the fact that the tech exists and you can impugn the integrity of the stuff that is real. That is where the significant danger lies, and it is already happening. We are witnessing the unraveling of shared reality. As Wurzel notes, the royal photo debacle is merely a microcosm of our current moment, where trust in both governing institutions and gatekeeping organizations such as the mainstream press is low. This sensation has been building for some time and was exacerbated by the corrosive political lies of the Trump era. We're going to talk about what the end of shared reality means for the future of our democracy coming up next. Is this real? That is the question millions of people had to ask themselves this week about this image published by one of the oldest institutions in the Western world, the British monarchy. As technology improves, people's ability to discern fact from fiction has worsened. The present scandal around the crown suggests that public trust, once shaken, can just disappear entirely. In a new article for The Atlantic, Charlie Worzell calls this moment the end of shared reality. He writes, for years, researchers and journalists have warned that deep fakes and generative AI tools may destroy any remaining shreds of shared reality. Experts have reasoned that technology might become so good at conjuring synthetic media that it becomes difficult for anyone to believe anything they didn't witness themselves. The royal portrait debacle illustrates that this era isn't forthcoming. We're living in it. Joining me now is Brian Tyler Cohen, host of the No Lie podcast and an MSNBC contributor. Brian, thank you so much for being here tonight. I'm super eager to hear your thoughts on this. Not what is going on with Kate Middleton, though. Our thoughts are with her wherever she is. But just the impact of a sort of seismic, you know, cultural event, internet event like this in terms of the broader question of public trust and how damaged you think it is even outside of the UK, even here in America.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, for example, robocalls, the Biden robocalls, if you look at the AI-generated images of Donald Trump surrounded by African-American voters, obviously they have the short-term impact of accomplishing what those AI-generated images or what those manipulated, you know, elements of those things are actually doing. So it has that benefit, first of all. But more insidiously, Republicans get the added benefit of shaking our faith in the reality of everything, that we don't know what's real. We don't know what's fake. We don't know what Joe Biden said, for example, or Donald Trump said, or what they didn't say. Because I think once we lose faith in the system, once more people more broadly lose faith in that system, they just check out. And so that's what Trump and Republicans want. This is the Steve Bannon model of flooding the zone, which I'm sure you're intimately familiar with. But Republicans want a political space that feels so inaccessible and so dirty and so manipulated and so broken that who would want to get involved? And that cynicism that they're kind of engendering here really does correlate to Republicans' message of American carnage and fear and dysfunction. So this is all, I think, a coordinated strategy, and it comes from the top down. Like, you know, you've heard the expression, the fish rots from the head, and that's what we're seeing here.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the hallmarks of autocracy is people losing faith in institutions, right? And you've already heard the cry of fake news. It really feels like this is the next prong in that strategy, which is anything that, you know, Trump and his supporters don't like on television, they say it's fake TV. And there's a very concrete example of that, right? The Lincoln Project came out with this ad, and let's play it first. This is an ad from the Lincoln Project.
Hey, Donald, we noticed something. More and more people are saying it. You're weak. You seem unsteady. You need help getting around. And wow.
An anomalous, really an anomalous country, and you deserve.
Are you sure you don't have dementia?
Okay, so that's an ad from the Lincoln Project. And in response to it, Trump says on Truth Social, the Lincoln Project and liberals are using AI in their fake television commercials in order to make me look as bad. I mean, this feels like the next front, right? If you are presented with, you know, visual evidence that doesn't seem favorable to your candidate and your candidate is Donald Trump, just call it fake. And I wonder how effective you think that's going to be more broadly.
I think it's going to be effective for the people who want, you know, who want to believe him. And that's what he'll do. I mean, everything is just as convenient as they want to make it. So in this case, if Donald Trump sees something that's his own words, which are obviously not going to be flattering. And if he wants to just write it off, then he has that as an excuse, as a fallback. And so he can just claim that it's an AI generated image. And by the way, that's kind of a tacit admission of how ridiculous the things he says are, that he even knows that he has to claim that what he said was fake. I think that's kind of the biggest tell of all.
Do you feel like, Brian, there's a way to put the toothpaste back in the tube, as it were? I mean, can you rebuild public trust in the 21st century? I ask that not as a nihilist, but as someone genuinely hopeful about, you know, institutional integrity.
I think it's going to take a lot of digital media literacy, which I don't know that we have right now, which is clear that we don't have right now. But it's also just, I mean, that's the reason I think that what you do is so important, what I try to do on a daily basis is so important. And that's just to kind of arm people with accurate information. Just having this segment right here where you let them know what's happening is a testament to that, is kind of shows why it's so important. And it arms people with the knowledge that this kind of stuff is happening. So all you can do is just continuously, you know, pelt people with the truth over and over and over again. And hopefully it has something of an impact. But it's going to, like I said earlier, it's going to take a lot of digital media literacy that we just don't have right now as a society.
Sunlight and literacy. Brian Tyler Cohen, it was great to see you. Thanks for joining the show tonight.
Thanks.
That is our show for this evening.